Good afternoon. My name is Kelly, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the State of Communities of Color in the Recession. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Cardenas, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Vanessa Cardenas, and I work at the Center for American Progress, and I would like to welcome you all to this call, where we're going to hear from a great lineup of speakers about how communities of colors are faring in the recession. And Christian Weller, a senior fellow and associate professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, is going to start us off, followed by Cy Richardson, Vice President of Housing and Community Development at the National Urban League. And after him, Eric Rodriguez will go on, as he's the Vice President of the Office of Research, Advocacy, and Legislation at NCLR. And our last speaker will be Romana Lee Akiyama, Deputy Director of the National CAPAC. And after that, we'll open it up for questions and answers. So with that, I'll turn it over to Christian.
Well, thank you very much, Vanessa. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. I will make 3 points in my remarks here. The first one is minorities have clearly experienced a much sharper drop in economic security than whites during this recession, and those drops happen from much lower levels of economic security for whites. My second point is that there are economic structures and not just personal differences that explain those differences, different experiences for minorities than for whites. And finally, that there are some public policy interventions that can be taken to level the playing field so that minorities can equitably share in a recovery and in the economy in the future. Let me just say, go into these points a little bit more in detail. The economic experience of almost all families in this recession has been dismal, but it's particularly bad for minorities relative to whites. The unemployment rate, which is one of the main indicators we would use, of whites increased by 4.2 percentage points from the end of 2007 when the recession started through the middle of 2009. In comparison, the unemployment rate of African Americans and Hispanics rose by more than 6 percentage points or 50% faster than for whites. We'll also see family incomes dropping. They're now at the lowest level since 1997. Employer benefits, especially health insurance and pension benefits, are disappearing faster for minorities than for whites during this recession. And that faster, again, this faster level decline comes after from lower levels. So lower incomes, less pension coverage, less health insurance coverage through employers, through employers. As I said, this was already the case before the recession hit, but it's not just the income side where minorities are finding themselves in a more precarious economic situation. It's also the wealth side. So if anything goes wrong, people lose a job, they have less of a private security blanket that they can fall back on. And one of the things we look at in particular is usually home ownership, the ability to borrow home equity, for instance. And if you look at home ownership rates, for instance, the home ownership rates in 2008, at 1 year into the recession, for whites was 75%, where it was 47.4% for African Americans and 49% for Hispanics. This is the lowest level of home ownership rates for whites and African Americans since 2002. It's the lowest home ownership rate for Hispanics since 2004. We also have seen recently data that the home ownership rates for Asian Americans has dropped faster than for any other group. So clearly something is happening on the wealth side. Again, the drops tend to be faster from lower levels for minorities than for whites. We also see other large differences in other forms of wealth. One of the main ones where we, as families, save the most is in our retirement savings account. And in 2008, African Americans had a pension coverage rate in the private sector of 46%, meaning 46% of private sector workers, African American workers, participated in a retirement plan. Only 30% of Hispanic workers participated, compared to 56% of whites. So there is less of a security blanket that minority minority workers can fall, minority families can fall back on if something goes wrong. And that explains to some degree the sharper rise in foreclosure rates, for instance, and default rates and bankruptcy rates among minorities than among whites, because there's less of a buffer if something goes wrong. The important piece, though, that I wanted to highlight is that building wealth is not just a question of do you have enough money to save, but also do you pay more for your checking accounts, for your savings accounts, for your mutual fund investments, or are you steered towards a higher cost of credit? And the evidence is clear that minorities tend to be steered more towards higher cost credit. In particular, minorities are much more likely to find themselves in higher cost products than whites, meaning installment loans, credit cards, payday lending, and so on and so forth. But even when they borrow from a credit card, when they borrow on installment loans, consumer loans, or when they borrow on payday lending, they tend to pay more for that than whites in a similar situation. My colleague Andrew Jakubovic recently issued a report looking at mortgages. I wrote a report a few years ago called Access Denied that highlighted those differences between minorities and whites. These differences, what we did in this report, though, are not necessarily – some differences between minorities and whites can be explained with demographic differences, younger ages, and so on and so forth. But there are also structural problems. And what we did in this report is we just simply looked at changes in the unemployment rate for whites and minorities by subgroups. So we divided the data by education levels, by age, by gender. And what you find is that in almost all cases, the unemployment rate for minorities rose faster than for whites. What explains those typically structure, what we consider structural obstacles. So what are those structural obstacles? They're segmented labor markets, a segregated housing market. They're in unequal access of transportation to get to a job. There are problems on the discrimination. There's credit steering, and so on and so forth, or what some people have called reversed redlining, targeting minority communities for high-cost, high-risk credit products, for instance. And so what I would advocate is that policymakers look at three different policy goals. The first one is to create good jobs, or what we call income opportunities. That means continuing the economic stimulus package, extending unemployment benefits. The House has approved that yesterday. But also structural long-term policies, for instance, making it easier for people to join a union through the Employee Free Choice Act, a higher minimum wage, improved earned income tax credit, and so on and so forth. The second bundle of policies goes to wealth building. And that it just simply means making it easier for people to save money. NCLR, for instance, has a number of very good proposals on financial education and financial advice that are worth looking into. Other things are making it more automatic for people to be enrolled in retirement savings plans, progressive tax matches for saving for retirement and other purposes, and lower cost savings options. Those things can disproportionately help minority workers. The final part is what I call market efficiencies, eliminating those structural obstacles that I've highlighted, especially in the credit market. There is a whole range of things we can discuss, but one thing that I think is tantamount that we should look at first is comes out of my colleague's Andrew Jakubovic's report, and that is to audit all of the TARP recipient banks to make sure that they have not engaged or engaging currently in credit steering practices that are detrimental to minorities. And only if the banks are getting a clean audit will they be allowed to return their TARP money. I'm happy to answer any other questions regarding policies, and I'll turn it over to the next speaker.
Great. Cy Richardson, can you please go now?
Thank you. I'd like to just pick up where Dr. Weller left off and provide an historical but also a structural and systemic approach to this question about how communities of color are falling behind within the economic downturn the country is faced with. The country is facing an economic crisis, and many are experiencing unprecedented instabilities. Individual Americans of all races, let's be clear, are facing dire situations, losing their jobs, homes, and broader security. Communities of color are affected disproportionately. Here, our collective message is the crisis is intensifying. The emergency now upon communities of color is the result of historic and current inequities, policies, and practices that block Black, Latino, Asian, and Native American people from opportunity and stability, and now plunges more families into despair. These disparities pose a real threat to the health of our national economy. These are not isolated issues we're talking about today. In contrast to our collective ideals, of fairness and opportunity, in the real world, these terms are really rigged against people of color in this country. The outcomes are not random and reflect neither merit nor skill. Rather, they are, I suppose, warped by a set of rules, practices, assumptions, and histories that position some at a disadvantage from the onset and continue to restrict opportunity at every turn. For example, the economic downturn with its tremendous job loss has exacerbated the already dire economic status of Black Americans. I mean, the latest unemployment figures for Blacks is simply staggering. In August 2009, last month, the unemployment rate rose to 9.7%, but the Black unemployment rate at a whopping 15.1%. And adult Black men saw their unemployment rate increasing significantly from 15.8% to more than 17%. And adult Black women saw an increase from 11% to nearly 12%. To dramatize the depth of the disparity between Blacks and whites with regard to unemployment, it must be noted that the current unemployment rate for white Americans is a shade under 9%, which is deemed extremely serious. But it's the same Black unemployment rate at the beginning of this recession that Blacks had. And I think that is a very important point to make. Income and wealth inequality is racialized in this country because the cumulative and compounding effects of past and present policies really generate deep racial disparities. I'd just like to point out one historical example, which is the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, which we all know as the GI Bill. I mean, it provides a clear example of the way that racial inequity accumulates over time. I mean, signed by FDR, the bill aimed to give every returning World War II veteran the opportunity to further his education, borrow money for a house or business, or receive a well-paying job. Yet veterans of color were blocked from buying homes during these post-war years by restrictive racial covenants that denied them access to mortgages. And as home ownership grew exponentially, right, the economic gap between white and non-white households widened, and the ripple effects we're still feeling today. I mean, across the country, people of color continue to face housing discrimination that builds upon that of the past and are relegated to precarious and low-wage jobs and regularly confront persistent barriers to opportunity. People of color, our message should be, have less accumulated wealth than whites and therefore less to fall back on in hard economic times. Yet the safety net for all poor people has been diminished, leaving many families without the support they need to survive. I'll just close by pointing out that these failures of public policy need to be addressed immediately as federal, state, and local governments implement job creation and economic recovery programs with funds provided from the stimulus. The persistent reality of these disparities means that without explicit attention to inequity, racial divisions will remain or really even grow. Racial inequity stands in the way of opportunity for communities of color and a healthy economy for all Americans. I think all the respondents today would underscore that point. But we need only the political will to adopt the many solutions available. Dr. Weller mentioned a few. We would offer up the reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act in a way that focuses on urban communities and communities of color for jobs is critical. We also think the CRA Modernization Act should be expanded, and that is critical. And we also believe the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is a critical component here. These policies will have to tackle both the institutional and historical roots of racial inequity that created an equal playing field for people of color in the first place, and the compounding effect of the multiple institutions that affect these communities today and moving forward. Those are my comments, and I can take questions later when we're finished. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And now Eric Rodriguez from NCLR.
Thank you. And thank you, Sai. Thank you, Christian, and certainly Amanda at the Center for American Progress for doing this important report, which really documents something that we've certainly known and certainly that we've seen in our communities for a long, long time, which is that minorities are the first to feel the effects of recession and are the slowest to get out of recessions. And it's important to put a lens on what's happening in communities. Now, you know, we started this year and the debate around the stimulus, you know, how big it should be, where it should be targeted, et cetera. And the notion that really prevailed was that the rising tide will lift all boats, that if we, you know, put a lot of money and sent it out into the states and spent it nationally, that would eventually trickle down to minority communities and minority workers in important ways. And we certainly had some real concerns about that, because that certainly proved not to be true in the past. But the fact is that the speed of which the legislation moved through the Congress, went to the president's desk, and the need to get that money out the door very quickly really hamstrung us in our ability to get some targeting and some direct resources in places that we thought would be important to directly address the problems that we're seeing right now, which is desperate outcomes and rising unemployment, staggering unemployment in many areas for minorities. But one thing I would just add to Sai's number is the youth unemployment rate is astronomical. For Latinos, it's 29.6% for Latinos 16 to 19 years old. And, you know, Latino workers are adding 50% of new workers to the economy all the time, many of which are just turning 18 years old. So these are pretty significant numbers and areas for us to look at. Now, I want to underscore that we're talking about, you know, minorities are taxpayers too, and they're out there and they've made contributions and they're working toward the economic recovery just like everybody else. Latinos believe in hard work, the value of work, are making contributions continuously to the economy, and minority workers are in many cases rebuilding America with their own bare hands. So it's important to note that the stimulus dollars and all the dollars that are being poured into recovery come from taxpayers like Latino, African Americans, and Asian workers and families all across America. And they're looking for direct investments and employment opportunities as well. The big concern, or one concern, is that we start to see the overall economy starting to heal as measured by growth and as measured by the markets, et cetera, but we still don't see improvements and greater stability for minority workers and families. That would not be a great outcome from where we sit. And so implementation of these efforts around, whether we're talking about the Recovery Act, or whether we're talking about the stimulus or housing, policies that we've put in place to help families facing foreclosure, if those programs don't start to work for minority families, that's exactly what we're going to see. We're going to see a broader economy, but higher inequality. And certainly that has long-term effects on the economy and the nation. But there are things we can do. We can work around implementation of these proposals. We can tweak them and refine them to make sure that minority families are getting benefits and employment opportunities just like everyone else. We can also look at ongoing debates that are going to have real significant implications on the financial and economic status of families. Healthcare is a perfect example of that right now, where the implications of that debate could be severe on low-income families if the bill isn't appropriately designed. Energy, green jobs, these are things that we're talking about right now that will involve huge sums of resources going into communities and into markets, where it'll be crucially important to make sure that minority workers and minority families are engaged in shaping those proposals and ultimately can be equal beneficiaries with their colleagues from those proposals as well. I would also underscore that it's critically important that we also focus on the quality of jobs. It isn't enough looking at the job market, and certainly where many Latino workers have been in the job market, whether we're talking about poultry or other places where the work environment and work and safety and other issues have been extremely hazardous and dangerous over the last 5 years, that the quality of the new workforce, the economy of the future and the labor market of the economy, and the labor market of the future, is enormously important, and we need to start having conversations about quality as well. So I'll stop there, and we'll hand it off and wait for questions later on. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Eric. And Romana?
Thank you, Vanessa. I just want to thank my colleagues for inviting me and National Capacity to participate in this call. It's an honor to stand with you all as fellow communities leaders and communities of color, representing practitioners and researchers who are helping to improve the lives of our minority communities in the United States. My name is Ramana Lee Akiyama, and I'm the Deputy Director of National Capacity. We are the National Coalition for Asian Pacific American Community Development, and we're a national advocacy organization dedicated to the housing and community development needs of low-income Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander communities. We are member-based, and we work with over 100 community-based organizations across the country from Boston to Hawaii. We're in 17 states and in 25 MSAs. Our member organizations represent organizations that are providing affordable housing, providing job training, workforce development, housing counseling, and a plethora of activities that are used to build assets in our lowest and most vulnerable communities, representing immigrants, refugees, indigenous people, in the case of Native Hawaiians. And let me just also say that this economic crisis, as my colleague Sai mentioned earlier, it has deeply touched the lives of all Americans, regardless of race, in particular in communities of color. We face disproportionate levels in homeownership attainment, employment, and education. And Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are no exception to this crisis. This morning, our executive director, Lisa Hasegawa, presented testimony to the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform that basically stated the following, and I'm going to touch on three areas. In regards to unemployment, how are Asian American and Pacific Islanders doing? I think the difficult thing for our community has always been that we struggle with this myth of a model minority, that as our numbers are aggregated, when you look at the diversity of the community, we represent numerous ethnic groups, which represent different languages, different cultures, different immigration histories, and when these numbers are aggregated, it looks like the community as a whole is doing better than we actually are. And so what we always try to do is disaggregate the data as much as possible. But in the case of the Bureau of Labor Statistics that had released unemployment data for our community, it is aggregated at this point. We were not able to disaggregate it. It actually did show that unemployment for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders has more than doubled since the fourth quarter of 2007. So looking a little bit deeper, we were able to pull data from the American Community Survey that was disaggregated. And as we predicted, communities who are representative of Southeast Asian countries, such as Cambodia, Laos, the Hmong population, these unemployment levels were higher than the national average. And so the numbers from 2005 to through 2007, this is prior to the recession, showed that the unemployment rate was higher at around 6%, while rates for Pacific Islanders were up at around 8 to 9%, which, as I just heard Sai say, is pretty much equal to how African Americans were doing prior to the recession. And so if we look at the trend data, we can only assume and imagine at this point, and again, going to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, showing that, yes, unemployment rates have increased for APIs as well. Okay. Secondly, I want to touch on small businesses and the link to employment stability. The rate of entrepreneurship and self-employment in API communities is particularly high, as it is common practice among API immigrants in particular as a means to overcome the language barriers that they would face if they were to go through traditional workforce development programs and then to be placed. I think the barrier is definitely language and being able to be English proficient. We know that many API small business owners were either locked out of credit markets or had equity previously tied up in their homes that they lost out on because of plummeting home values. And so the money that they would be able to put back into their businesses was severely hampered. In addition, API small business owners also would use credit cards to buy stock that they needed for their businesses. And because the credit market has dried up, they also were in a way disabled and were not able to grow their businesses. So for APIs, it's very important to note that foreclosures, unemployment, and small businesses are intricately tied together. And lastly, I just want to touch on foreclosures. Dr. Weller referenced some statistics that came out just 2 days ago. The American Community Survey data showed that Asians were actually the hardest hit of all racial groups in this country, even more than whites in 2008, and that our homeownership rates have dropped by 1.24%. African Americans saw a 0.88% decline in homeownership rates, and Latinos saw a 0.8% decline, whereas whites saw a drop by 0.4% in their homeownership rates. And so we're very much concerned that this information, this new information that has come to us, is a signal to us that something is systemically preventing our community members from accessing services that they need, such as foreclosure counseling in language. That has been a barrier that National Capacity has continued to work with to address. And many of the community-based organizations that provide crucial services to limited English proficient individuals and families have been left out of certain stimulus funding. And I will end with some recommendations. Regarding employment issues, we recognize that stimulus dollars were there to generate the economy quickly, and we understand that. But unfortunately, there were communities, such as communities of color, that were left out from accessing the funds because the funds were put into already existing infrastructure that did not necessarily have a focus on serving underserved communities. And now we need to go back and prioritize communities of color and the service systems that are in place to efficiently and effectively serve communities of color. And regarding foreclosure issues, I think considering the new data that has been available to us, now is the time to look deeply at what's been happening in API communities. We've experienced the sharpest decline in homeowner rates, and we're asking for HUD, Treasury, NeighborWorks America, Freddie, and Fannie to collectively and comprehensively support system development to serve limited English proficient borrowers, particularly those that do not have access to community-based resources. Thank you, and I'll take questions.
Great. Thank you, Romana. And before we open up the lines for Q&A, I wanted to note that the Center for American Progress released a report today authored by Dr. Christian Weller, as well as Amanda Logan. And the report is called Leveling the Playing Field, How to Ensure Minorities Share Equitably in Economic Recovery and Beyond. And that's available on our website. And with that, operator, can we please open up the lines now for questions?
Yes. If you would like to ask an audio question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. You have a question from Eric Galindo.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering if you guys have had any communication with the White House as to anything specific that the White House has planned to deal with the issue of how minorities are being impacted by the economy?
This is Christian Weller. We haven't talked specifically to the White House about this, but this was an extended hearing this morning in the House of Representatives before the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. So there is clearly policy attention being paid to this. I expect similarly that the White House is having conversations. I couldn't confirm that or deny that. But let me, while I'm here, just like make clear that the main point that Sai, Romana, Eric, and I really want to get out there is that there is an unlevel playing field. We cannot simply wait for the labor market, for the economy to turn around and then cross our fingers and hope that everything will work out just fine. The experience of the last few years, as Eric pointed out, has shown that just simply job growth is not good enough. If you look at what has happened to the Hispanic community, the employment growth before the crisis was actually stronger among Hispanics than among whites or among African Americans. But a lot of the jobs that were created weren't jobs that afforded Hispanics a minimum level of economic security. So when those jobs went away, there weren't enough savings, there weren't enough benefits to really buffer the impact of this major recession. So I think the main thing, and then Sai put this very articulately, are these institutional impediments that Sai highlighted in particular. They are longstanding and they need to be addressed. We cannot just simply like sit back, cross our fingers, and hope that the economy will take care of this.
Yeah, this is Eric with NCLR. I would just add to that. Thank you, Christian. Those are good points. That we certainly have had conversations with administration officials at the Department of Labor, Housing and Urban Development, and the Treasury about the different pieces of, or the various interventions that have been put in place so far. Many that are reflected in our testimony today as well to the Congress around how these policy interventions are impacting communities of color. So they are aware that there are concerns and that there need to be changes in the way that these programs are being implemented in order for them to make the kinds of changes or have the kind of results that are ultimately going to be positive for Latino families and workers. So they are aware of that. I think there's a sincere, at least they have expressed to us some sincerity in trying to fix and tweak these programs. And certainly the more that they hear from communities and community-based institutions that are engaged in helping to provide services either through HUD or HHS or the other agencies so that they can refine and tweak what they're doing, the better.
Yeah, this is Sai. I'd like to echo the previous statements. And we, too, the Urban League, have had conversations, continue to have conversations with those folks who understand and are interested in kind of urban pathologies and responses to them. We've talked particularly with folks over at Labor about, you know, efforts to revitalize the job market. I mean, to the point, let's be clear, if construction jobs, for example, and this came up in the second panel of this morning's hearing, if construction jobs continue to go mainly to white males who already dominate the construction trades, many people who need jobs the most, women, minorities, and the poor, and the long-term unemployed, will be shut out. I mean, I think we have to look at structurally what, and in a more granular way, what needs to be tweaked, what needs to be amended, what needs to be reformed and overhauled to ensure the kind of equity and that we're all talking about here.
Your next question comes from Rob Unia.
Thank you. I think the last speaker just touched on my question a little bit, but I guess I just wanted somebody to elaborate a little bit on what kinds of policies they would like to see, maybe focusing on, and I heard the stimulus package mentioned a few times. Are there any specific examples of things the government could do to improve things?
Well, this is Christian. I'll leave the stimulus question particular to the other three organizations. I typically focus on data and the national data and some of the national federal economic policies. I think on the stimulus, the main point is to continue the stimulus. There has been some discussion over whether to stop it. Clearly, we need to continue it to make sure we stop the bloodletting from this recession. We need to extend and improve unemployment benefits. As we highlighted several times today, the unemployment rates tend to be much higher among minority communities across the spectrum, Hispanics, African Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, than for whites. And one thing we didn't highlight, but again, it's very likely that the long-term unemployment, which is a persistent problem in this recession, is also more and more severe problem among minorities, the communities of color. So improving unemployment benefits is certainly one step. So like maintaining the stimulus, making sure that the money gets out as quickly as possible, making sure that all communities have access to the spending dollar that's coming now, and that the unemployment insurance benefits are improved again, are certainly the first few steps. The other parts I would highlight is certainly there's regulatory policies, especially related to the labor market, and that means an improved minimum wage, for instance, or labor law reform that makes it easier for people to join a union. In particular, Hispanic workers tend to gain substantially from joining a union relative to other communities. And then finally, I think while we focused right now, given where we are, so much on the labor market. I think there is this other part that because of the wealth inequality that Sai in particular highlighted, if something goes wrong, there is more of a buffer for white families than there is typically for minority families. And so you do need to focus on wealth creation, private wealth creation. And that does require a thorough review of competitiveness policies in the financial markets, continuation and improvements to the Community Reinvestment Act, to make sure that these practices that we've seen of credit steering, especially towards African Americans, but also for Hispanics and other, some of the Asian American communities, will have no more place in our credit markets, that everybody has access to affordable, stable credit products, and that we don't get this reverse redlining that we have seen in the last few years.
This is Sai with the Urban League. Just as a coda to Christian's point, I think, we all represent progressive and responsible organizations here, but we're not in favor of wanton spending. I think we're in favor of targeted spending around solutions that make sense. I mean, two points that we support would be, one, specifically, increased funding for proven and successful models of workforce training and job placement for underskilled workers between the ages of 16 and 30. Eric makes a good point about, we're missing a generation here. The younger generation is quite critical, and it seems to be lost oftentimes in this discussion and discourse. And so we can do that by utilizing national intermediaries, like many of the groups on the call here, and other nonprofit organizations. We can also direct a percentage of all infrastructure monies to job training, job placement, and job preparation for disadvantaged workers. I think that will be a very public and visible attempt to demonstrate that this administration understands structurally where it needs to butter its bread, as it were.
Okay. There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. All right. If there are no more questions, then thank you very much for joining us on this call. If you have any questions, you can feel free to get in touch with me. My name again is Vanessa Cardenas at the Center for American Progress. My phone number is 202-481-8112. Thank you so much to our speakers. And for more information, please visit our websites. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.